On today's episode of The Good Word, Nekias Duncan from the Dunker Spot joins the show and helps us to recap last night's play-in games, preview Friday night's win or go home matchup against the Pelicans and Kings, and we're going to preview the entire Western Conference first round matchups. All that and much more coming up on today's episode.
Good Word with Goodwill on Yahoo Sports. Ball don't lie. And here is Vince Goodwill.
Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. We are part of the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Get us wherever you get your podcast. We are also on YouTube. So if you're on YouTube, you can see the face of the gentleman next to me. You're like, man, who's this dude? He ain't never been on this podcast, but he is somebody that I've been a huge fan of for a long time. And I'm really honored that he could join us today, even though I'm in Sacramento. I think, are you in New York?
No, I'm back home. I'm in Charlotte now.
Okay. That is the voice of Nekias Duncan. Nekias is the host of The Dunker Spot along with Steve Jones Jr. It's one of those X's and O podcasts for real basketball junkies. Like, he's found a real following on social media through the years. Man, he's been an up and coming star. One of my friends, Ethan Skolnick, years ago said, Nekias Duncan is a star. He's a star. I'm like, all right, cool. Start following him and figured out that he is indeed a star. So don't forget to go check him out. And there's a series, I think, before we even start, the series that you guys have with the coaches, that you and Steve do with the NBA coaches, where the coaches get on the board and they literally just break down plays. Like, it's so simple and yet so fun. Like, what do you learn in those spots? Or, you know, from some of those coaching breakdowns?
One is just kind of fun to hear, like, the philosophy of some of these coaches. Because, like, Steve naturally has the actual NBA coaching experience. I just watch a bunch of hoop. And so I picked up stuff, you know, from Steve and just watching a bunch. But it's very cool to hear different rationales behind, oh, we're running this because this is what we're trying to get to. We're spacing this guy in this corner because this is how the defense is going to react. And this stuff that I could pick up on, like, 40% of it on my own from watching. But, like, hearing coaches and, you know, Steve, and again, as he has the experience and has played and all this good stuff, it's cool to kind of get that rationale behind it. And also, just, we never really get to hear from coaches, like, unless you are in arena and you're working a beat and you get to talk. And even then, it's very much, I will give you what I want to give you. So actually, the concept of a coach actually going through basketball stuff without trying to hide things is a very cool experience. And we've had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, there was a thing, I want to say, was it a Dallas Spurs game? And Popovich ran some type of action that got an alley-oop, like, at the rim with, like, a few seconds left in regulation. And to watch him go through each sort of movement, intricacy, back screen, like, okay, you know what I mean? Like, that stuff to me is always really fascinating because it happens so fast, you don't catch everything. And even if you watch it three or four times in real speed, you don't catch it all and you don't understand all the time, all the logic. So it's really fascinating to go there. But I'm in Sacramento. But before we go to Sacramento Golden State, I made the mistake. I won't say made the mistake. Nekias, I had Bomani Jones on the podcast on Monday, and I said, Zion Williamson has never had a signature game that matters in his NBA career, where there was a game of consequence, and he put up numbers, and he put up an effect. And then last night, he gave it to us. He was the one dude who showed up early and often in that game against the Lakers. They looked like they were going to stalk the Lakers and take them down. Mm-hmm. And after he scored his 40th point, it was a hamstring or a leg or something. I think Willie Green said it was leg soreness, but they're getting the MRI done. Like, what did you see from Zion last night? Just overall, 40-11 and 5 assists. Like, he was a man in a bunch of different ways.
It was an incredible performance, first and foremost. Very dull analysis there. But I really appreciated the problem-solving aspect from Zion, because I think throughout the regular season series, we've seen a lot of LeBron taking on the Zion matchup, and something that Steve in particular has hit on is how far back LeBron has played off of Zion in those matchups. Yes. And so the Pelicans have done a good job overall this year of getting the ball to Zion on the move. They'll have him just cut from the corner, catch the ball on the move, get downhill. They'll run handoffs for him. We've had the whole point Zion experiment where he's just running traditional ball screens. And LeBron James in their regular season matchups, and you saw particularly in the first half of the game last night, LeBron's like, I'm just going to chill at the free throw line or at the block. You will meet me whenever you want to come down here, and you have fun trying to deal with that. And so for Zion to try to piece through that and still maintain his aggression through most of the first half, he really kept him afloat in the first quarter. And then the second half, between the Pelicans trying to move Zion around some more and ultimately leaning on, okay, let me see if I can get this Anthony Davis matchup, which sounds wild as a concept because Anthony Davis has been one of the best defenders in the league. Should probably make an all defense team. If not the first team, definitely the second team. He's going to be in the defensive player of the year race. I don't think he's going to win it, but it seems weird to say that Zion was targeting him, but just because of this, I think the strength difference, a higher center of gravity for AD, Zion really found some comfort in the second half saying, okay, fine. If we can get this switch, or if I just get this matchup, I'm just driving through and around this dude. And to watch that relentlessness where in a game where CJ McCollum didn't really have it, Brandon Ingram really didn't have it and ultimately didn't close out that game. And you got timely shot making from the bench, two big threes from Trey Murphy III, Jose Alvarado's doing some fun stuff, pick and roll. But it was largely Zion kind of leading the charge. And in particular, getting to the paint, it was really Zion. And watching him go through Anthony Davis, of all people, to get that done, it was very impressive. And so watching just kind of the chess match there about how he's going to get his touches, how he's going to get downhill, and what would lead to more fit the finishes there. And, you know, you zoom out, look at the box score, 40 and 11 is insane. And to your point about the stakes, like the Pelicans are trying to make the playoffs. It wasn't the best end to their season. They had been top 10 defense throughout the league. They've had extended stretches of the offense looking really good. They didn't close out the season as strong as they could have. A lot of that is due to injury. And so for him to kind of just reclaim, like, no, I'm still here. This is the Zion you were promised. I will put this on my back. I got this.
And, you know, Nakai, the thing that I've always been curious about when teams give Zion that much space, I'm like, you're giving him a runway for momentum. You're giving mm-hmm. him a chance to generate his power base and run into you. That doesn't seem like a fun party, but LeBron might be the one player who chest to chest can absorb the contact, even though he took that one.
I was about to say, there was the one kind of. That man's yeah, legs
was there. It looked like it hurt, though.
Yeah.
It looked like it hurt. But to me, what do you think of that strategy that teams are doing, Zion? Because I felt like Boston did it, but Boston had the length to sort of dig in when he starts to drive to sort of make him think a little bit. Most teams don't have the length on the help to do that, nor do most teams really try that. I feel like that's not necessarily a great strategy because who wants to stand in there and potentially take a charge from this dude?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to your point, like you have to have very specific personnel to be able to pull that portion off. And I think that's also been kind of the hidden goodness of this Zion season post All-Star break, or really over the last month, to where you're starting to see him being more intentional about actually taking pull-up twos. And it hasn't been the most efficient shot for him yet, but you can see he feels like, okay, this is a counter that I'm going to need. If not a pure pull-up, then at least a floater. If you're going to give me that space, I can chew up this space, get into the air and finish over length. Or I can get you backpedaling. I can now just get an uncontested shot from, you know, between 8 and 10 feet. And so as he becomes more comfortable with that, I don't know how viable that strategy is going to be, especially if he ends up with a pull-up or a floater. If LeBron's going to play that far back, or Kristaps Porzingis, if he gets that matchup, he's going to play that far back. Like Zion can now just flow into uncontested looks that aren't three-pointers. And so you're still putting a level of pressure on the paint, if not the rim altogether, and you're getting comfortable looks for him. He's able to maintain rhythm. And then if you go to something else, it's just back to the Zion package, and good luck dealing with that.
Yeah, like the plan B is find a way to get back to plan A, and plan A is to beat you to death, like that sort mm-hmm. of thing. Like, and now we've got the MRI coming up, and we don't know at this time. I think it's like 11:25 Eastern time, so we haven't heard anything from Willie Green. They have until Friday. This is Wednesday. How do you see that matchup sort of playing out? I guess with the uncertainty of Zion because he wasn't able to finish. New Orleans, if you believe in momentum, they had all the momentum. They had the Lakers on the ropes. He had just tied the game after being down 18. And they didn't crumble, but the game turned on its face a little bit after that. How do you see a Kings-Pelicans matchup playing out without Zion Williamson if that does happen?
Well, naturally, you take a hit just because he's the one guy for the Pelicans who you could just trust. He will generate a paint touch. And Sacramento, as well as they played defensively in the second half of the year, like they still don't have a traditional rim protector. Like Zion, in theory, like he still could just get into the chest of DeMontis Sabonis, and good luck with that. If you get Alex Lynn in the game, you get him out in space, you are able to drive around him. Or you could just kind of beat him to spots even if he is in a drop. So without Zion, I do think the paint pressure in general is going to be a lot tougher for New Orleans. And this really just becomes a super fun matchup because the Pelicans have had a lot of success against the Kings this year. A lot of that is Zion. A lot of that is CJ McCollum just turns into Jesus Christ himself when he faced the Kings. Have you seen his numbers against the Kings this year?
I know they're really good. I haven't seen, I don't know exactly, but I know he's, because he's been on a roll the past, like, what, 10, 11 games anyway.
Mm-hmm. Three games against the Kings this year. 26.6 assists. It sounds modest, but still very good. 70.4% from 3-on-9 attempts.
Who's guarding him? Yep.
It does not matter. It does not matter. So, but I say that to say it gets even more interesting because, you know, I've talked about the Kings this year as they've lost Kevin Herter, lost Malik Monk. That's a lot of shooting, a lot of shot creation. It hits the handoff base that the Sacramento Kings want to get to. Yep. But now you sub in more Keon Ellis, really good defender, more Davion Mitchell, really good defender. I do wonder how that, plus Zion potentially missing that game on Friday, how that's going to affect the New Orleans offense. If you now see more Keon Ellis or more Davion Mitchell on CJ McCollum.
Yeah.
If you're able to get Keegan Murray, who, you know, saw a lot of Steph last night and saw some Clay as well. If he's on Brandon Ingram, that's not the same movement element that you got to deal with. Do the Kings have a better shot defensively now? So I think the Zion thing really plays a role in this. One, because Zion is really good. But now that you add in, you know, more defensive reinforcements for Sacramento due to injury, and now you're taking away the guy that can just consistently get you two on the ball or really threaten the paint in Zion, it may make it a little bit easier for the Kings to deal with that. And if the Pelicans turn the ball over or if they just don't have the three ball going, which they did, they didn't really have the three ball going overall last night. Kings get out in transition. The scales could tip here.
Well, it's funny because last night, I saw the Kings play more focused brand of defense that I don't think I've ever seen them play. Mm-hmm. Like, they had Steph. He saw literally three people in his face at all times. You run a screen to him, and that was like the worst thing. Oh, we're going to have literally we're blitzing, and we're having an extra defender on the wing to his strong side. And he had no space. And because the Warriors didn't seem to have a secondary ball handler scorer outside of one stretch where Jonathan Kuminga, when he had Sabonis on him, like had him for food in the second quarter. Like that was the strategy for them as we sort of transition to Golden State. And before we even go to Golden State's future, and we have plenty of time to sort of dissect all of that. I was really impressed with De'Aaron Fox's defense. Like, cause they placed him on Andrew Wiggins and Wiggins was bringing the ball to the floor. And he had all types of trouble dealing with De'Aaron Fox and his quickness. He just basically disrupted the timing and flow of Golden State's entire timing and flow-based offense.
Mm-hmm. Even, like, they moved De'Aaron around. Like, I think they started the game with De'Aaron on Draymond. Like, Draymond got to open the corner three, but I was like, wait, this is interesting. They're going to let De'Aaron Fox roam around because he is really good in the passing lanes. If they do try to go Steph, Draymond, pick and roll, that could just be a switch. And now you have Steph, you know, De'Aaron Fox on Steph, which, you know, that could go either way. Like, Steph obviously still a great right. player. But just conceptually, okay, they can kind of flatten a lot of this stuff out. And now you have an extra help point to play with. It's good stuff. And then you have a little bit more length on Steph and Clay because you're moving De'Aaron Fox around there. And you mentioned the Andrew Wiggins portion. Part of why the Warriors will have, like, Wiggins bring the ball up on a straight possession or Kuminga bring it up or have Clay bring it up so they can get to some of the Steph off-ball stuff. If Steph right. is getting hounded off the ball, a lot of physicality. Keon Ellis did a really good job. Again, Keegan Murray had some reps early in that game. If you're able to disrupt things and get the Warriors deeper into the clock there, or if you can't even get there because De'Aaron Fox is just pressuring whoever's bringing the ball up, it kind of bled into the turnover issues that you saw for the Warriors in that game. So I'm with you that the game plan was sound. Domantas Sabonis worked his tail off defensively, getting up to the level, hanging for yes. some straight double teams, was in a drop when appropriate, rotations were there. Like, it wasn't a perfect game for him by any means. But he had the scheme nuance necessary to deal with Golden State's offense. And ultimately, they just could not really get it going consistently in that game.
And for me, the effort and the concentration from Sabonis, because I was there in that game 5 last year. I was there in game 7 last year where Sabonis was the mark. Mm-hmm. Like, they were like, this is the matchup that we're going to seek out. We're going to put him in a bunch of different actions. We're going to make him make a lot of decisions that he doesn't want to make. And this one was like, no, he's dictating the terms of the matchup. Mm-hmm. Even if he wasn't involved in the screen, he wasn't lost. He wasn't out of place. Like you said, it wasn't a perfect game, but he seemed to be close to where he needed to be almost at all times. And holding the Warriors to 94 points yeah. and having that game be effectively over Nikias in the third quarter. Like, the game was over in the third quarter. Like, I'm looking around on press row. I'm like, they're not winning this game. You know, and now that you look at the future, you know, there's the money element of it. There's the Klay Thompson element of it. There's a Stephen Curry, Draymond Green element of it. I don't see a clear path for the Warriors to truly improve. You know what I mean? Because they don't necessarily have the resources. You got the salary cap constraints and everything else. Like, this just feels like a slow burn, especially if they, if Klay Thompson, who scored as many points as you, me, and John last night.
Yeah, like, they're in a tough spot, especially with the second apron concerns. And beyond that, like, I don't know where you go, because, like, they're not trading Steph. They're not about to start any kind of rebuild. They're not about to press that button unless Steph asks for them to press that button. And even then, like, I don't see Steph pressing that button. So we can take that off the table. Like, as weird as the season was for Draymond Green, for you can pick your reason for why the season was weird, I think the Warriors have given us enough of a sample size. No, they're not getting rid of Draymond unless, again, unless Steph presses that button specifically. Like, hey, I know how good, how important he is, or how important he has been. We can't keep having these stretches during seasons or in training camp or whatever the case may be. This has to be the move. I don't see Steph pressing that button either. And so I think if you're looking for a major move for Golden State, like, it's probably going to involve Andrew Wiggins, if I had to guess. Yeah. But even then, like, what are you getting there? Like, I don't know if you get a game changer in an Andrew Wiggins deal unless you are packaging Wiggins with something. So I guess with that being said, like, just kind of keeping tabs on the first round of the playoffs this year. Minnesota, they're going to have some salary stuff to play with if they lose. Phoenix, naturally, if they lose to Minnesota, those conversations get interesting. If Orlando beats Cleveland, what happens with Donovan Mitchell? So, like, there are going to be some names. And obviously, we got the Chicago-Atlanta play-in game a little bit later tonight. There's been a whole lot of
smoke. Is that actually happening? It's like one of those trees in the forest things. Nobody hears it. Like, is that actually happening tonight?
I feel like I'm one of, like, 14 people interested in this basketball game. But either way, if the Hawks lose that game, there's been plenty of rumblings about what happens with Trey and or DeJounte. So there will be names, I would imagine, that will become available. But then it goes back to what you said. What are the resources that the Warriors even have to pull off something like that? But I would imagine they at least try to sniff around those, because, like, I don't think Steph's going anywhere. You can build a case for why it's probably time to trade Draymond Green, but they just gave him the extension last year. So, like, he's not going anywhere. I think Andrew Wiggins is probably the move, because ultimately I don't see them getting off of John DeCaminga either. Like, he's probably the young piece that they can move. But considering we are at the tail end of this, if not the end of this, I don't know if I want to trade that guy with what he showcased after the Athletic article came out.
Dude, I'm going to tell you this. That 2022 title is looking more and more remarkable by the day.
It is. It sure is.
You know, not lucky. I don't want to say lucky, because I don't want to put that sort of verbiage out there. But it's just looking remarkable that Andrew Wiggins, A, was their second best player. B, that they were able to sort of keep it all together, including, you know, Jordan Poole with everything that happened later. Like, a lot of things fell right for them to squeeze out that fourth title. Mm-hmm. And Steve Kerr knows how this works. Like, he said it last night, you know, you don't stay on top forever. Like, he's got 2 years left. Draymond's got a few years left. Steph Curry has 2 years left. Like, it's looking like the contracts are lined up to say, all right, there's a finite ending to this. Mm-hmm. But they have 46 wins this year. It's just that there's so many good teams that have erased the margin for error in the Western Conference.
Yeah, like, they aren't that far off their pace from last year, and it didn't matter because of how strong the West is getting. And, you know, projecting forward next year, like, how many years are we giving the Spurs to pass the Warriors? And even before pressing the Wimpy button, the Houston Rockets.
Yeah, I would say next year. I would say next year, right? Would you say next year?
I need to see what they do this offseason. Like, I don't want to doubt Wimpy, but they just got to get the defense together overall. So I'll probably say, we'll give it 2 years conservatively before the Spurs are just ready to be a playoff team. The Rockets almost passed the Warriors this year in the play-in. Ultimately, schedule got tougher for Houston. Golden State was able to string together wins. They ended up closing out. But, like, they aren't that set in stone to begin with. So it's really getting dicey. I'm really curious to see what kind of moves they are able to do, considering kind of the core constraints and the money constraints that they have.
Look, you just named, there's 10 teams in the West, and Golden State was 10. Sacramento was 9. You just mentioned San Antonio. You just mentioned Houston. Ja Morant, assuming that, you know, Ja doesn't do anything silly in the offseason, Memphis will be back.
They were just top three seed last year. Like, yeah.
Look, it's I'm not one of those people that goes full into the NBA playoffs should be like 16 teams. Like, I think at some point, the great players will start to age out and mm-hmm. The talent will sort of flatten out and you will see exactly where, you know, things are going. Like Kevin Durant will be 36. Mm-hmm. Steph Curry just turned 35. LeBron James is 135 years old. Like at some point this will end, mm-hmm. right? Like you're seeing sort of, believe it or not, people, as good of a basketball game that was from LeBron James yesterday, I saw an old man looking old at various points that did not have a lot of explosiveness and a lot of lift. And then you're asking him to go into Denver to play the champs. Mm-hmm. That is a task that I'm not sure I necessarily, you know, want to go to. And you saw Klay Thompson was 34 years old. Like this is what happens in professional sports. I think, mm-hmm. I think LeBron has sort of changed it a little bit, Nikias, because we're not used to seeing runs end. We're used to seeing guys pick up and leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like LeBron's been a part of it, KD, like all these guys, to where we're looking at, because there's been, you know, the rumblings about Steph Curry and what the second half of his years look like. I just pulled it up. His last 13 games, 24 points per game, 45% from the field, 43% from three. 24-6 is not Steph range. No. But you think about 36-year-old guard. If a 36-year-old guard is averaging 24-6 over any stretch, you are throwing a parade. But like that's just the standard that Steph Curry has set and what a lot of these older guys have continued to set. But to your point, like, yeah, it does. How much longer can you rely on Steph to be the guy by himself? I think it's very clear he is going to be an ever-present threat until the day that he retires and probably a couple of weeks after that. You see him in the grocery store, you're still going to commit two to him. So like that's just going to be the attention that he draws. But as far as Steph, we need you to give us 28-5-5 every night and do it efficiently. That's not a fair ask to him. Not even, you know, not speaking to his talent, but just the responsibility and the defensive coverages that he gets. It's not fair to ask for him to do that while also Klay might drop 25. He might give you 12. Andrew Wiggins might give you 20. He might give you 8. Jonathan Kuminga may give you 20 points. He might play 20 minutes the next night. It's not fair to ask Steph to carry that load for 82 games. And like, that's where some of the minute load conversations popped up. Like, why is Steph only playing 32, 33 minutes? Because he's 36. And he's still running around literally more than just about any other player in the league because of how they use him. Yeah, I don't want to play that dude 40 minutes a night either, even if the talent level and the impact warrants that as the Warriors try to close into the playoff seat. That's not a fair ask to him.
No, and look, I asked Steph last night. I brought up, look, I didn't say it because you can't say, hey, Steph, you didn't have a really good post-All-Star break. You can't ask a player that in the press conference setting because it won't be received well. But right. I didn't say, hey, did you experience fatigue? How do you feel now? And he said, look, I feel fresh. If there was a game on Friday, he's like, it's April 16th. I'm used to playing much later. But mm-hmm. to me, that says also, I'm old and I'm not going to tell y'all that I'm old and I'm going to engage in a little bit of like cognitive dissonance here where I'm not supposed to admit that I'm tired and all mm-hmm. that. But he depends so much on being in the best shape possible that I don't know, Nikias, what the profile of the perfect player to put next to him as he ages to mm-hmm. max him out. I don't know what that looks like. Not him, not even him as best player. If he's 1B, who would 1A look like?
LeBron, funny enough. But like even then, like that's just like you're talking two aging players, two great all NBA caliber players still, to be very clear about that. Two future Hall of Famers, like, probably very conservatively, like two of the top, 15 players Easily. Of all time? Conservatively. Now, you can argue both of those guys higher. But they are in that class. But even then, if that's the best you're getting, what is the shelf life of that? I know what the ceiling is. Those two can win the title together next year if they build the right team around it. But like, how long can you keep that together? I don't know. And like, that's kind of the pickle that Golden State's in. And it kind of circles back to 2021 draft, 2022 draft. Where's the next phase coming in at? Like the whole two timeline thing, ultimately, it didn't work out the way that Golden State wanted it to. And now we're here.
Well, the two timeline thing hinged on Jordan Poole. A player that nobody actually believed was incorporated in that. He was the bridge, and he kept it upright long enough until Draymond put him not upright anymore. Like, that's just kind of, sorry about that. All right. John's probably losing this right now that I'm not making the Mike Tyson punch out joke with Draymond Green and, you know, the video games that I used to play on Nintendo back in the day. But that's what it was. And they squeezed y'all. I think people will further understand, especially in the age of parity. And I think Denver's going to repeat this year, but we've had five different champions in the last 5 years. Like, that 2022 championship was so freaking improbable. I would say impressive. More improbable, I would just say, man, they really found a sweet spot. They found a sweet spot. And that's what it was. And we're going to be right back when the Kaius Duncan is like, look, if you want to hear a preview of tonight's play-in games, Monday's episode with Bomani, me and him talked about that a little bit. We didn't give much time to the Hawks and Bulls because they're both going home after Friday anyway. But we're going to pause, we're going to pay some bills, and then we'll be right back. Back here on A Good Word with Nekias Duncan. Nekias, we don't know exactly who the Thunder will be playing when they start their series. This could be New Orleans, it could be Sacramento. What I will say when we just deep dive or just sort of look at the Thunder as a whole, everybody looks at them and says, oh, they're the young team. You want to line yourself up to play against them. Nekias, I don't look at them, even though they're a young team, average age 23.5 in the starting lineup and, you know, Shea and everything else. I don't look at them as a young team that does young team things. Like, they don't turn the ball over. They don't have long lapses defensively. Like, they don't do things that we would consistently associate with young teams that are ripe to get beat in their first real playoff series. Is that how you see them?
Yeah, like, that's kind of been my pushback to some of the Thunder angst. Like, are the lights going to be too bright for them? Stuff like, no, not really. Like, I feel like if they lose a series, whether that's first round, second round, conference finals, whatever the case may be, if they lose, it's going to be because they were one of the best three-point shooting teams in the league when I didn't expect that, and I was high on the Thunder. If they shoot 34% from three in a series and teams are able to load up on Shea, they lose if the offense dips. They're not going to lose because Shea is throwing the ball out of bounds four times because he can't handle a trap. I don't think they're going to lose because Lou Dort has just lost his head or something like that, and he gets a flagrant two at a weird spot. Like, that's just not the profile of this team. Like, very, 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 very fun group to watch. They do not care about their opponents. And I say that respectfully. Like, they're not scared of it.
Yes.
Is more so what I mean. It's like, I don't see them like that. And then just looking at the profile, per clean the glass, top five in offense and defense. Like, it's them in Boston that did that. Like, that doesn't feel a young team for me, especially on the defensive end. And this is a team you add Chet Holmgren, who had, I don't think he makes an all defense team this year, but he certainly was in that class in terms of what he did defensively. But then they just have a bunch of speed around that. They double team at a high rate. They rotate pretty well out of those double teams. If you turn the ball over against them, you're pretty much dead on arrival. And you got to work so hard to generate looks. And just within the context of if it's the Pelicans or if it's the Kings, if the Pelicans have a hampered Zion or don't have them at all, who do the Thunder feel like they need to load up against?
No, everybody can stay home.
Yeah, like, I don't think you need to load up against the Brandon Ingram. You give Lou Dort that matchup, or if you want to give Jalen Williams that matchup, put Lou Dort elsewhere. You do that, and if they hit enough shots, then sure, we can double. Like, we've seen in, like, some of the Phoenix games, like, Kevin Durant's bringing it up. They are trapping him at half court and then just kind of playing out of that. So, like, I don't think you have to load up to that degree if Zion is not there or if he's hampered. And with the Kings, De'Aaron Fox, obviously very good. Domantas Sabonis, obviously very good. No Kevin Huerter, no Malik Monk. You lose that shot creation. You lose that shooting. You could turn more of those handoffs into switches or more of those handoffs into unders if you want to. And now if you do want to double-team Domantas Sabonis, if you're worried about him hitting Chet Holmgren in the chest, okay, let's help off of Keon. Make four or five threes again. If Davion Mitchell's in the game, cool. Let's help off of him. Let's send a double from his guy. Or let's send a double from one pass away. And as we rotate behind that, we're going to make sure Davion's the one that's wide open. Make two or three threes. Like, it just becomes so much easier for them to kind of scheme if you want to poke at their defense because of who they'll be facing in this series. So, like, not that the Pelicans or the Kings couldn't get a game or two off of them, because they do still have some size advantages. They do still have some things to poke at. But as far as being worried that the Thunder would lose a series against either of those two, I'm not there.
No, I think the Lakers were worst case scenario. But even I'm not exactly sure if the Lakers, even what we saw the regular season, like, the Lakers just were just bigger and thicker, lack of a better phrase. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? To come down, they just made the Thunder real uncomfortable on the glass. And that part is to be expected. But I don't even know if that would hold serve over a 7-game series. Now you're looking at the Lakers' worst possible matchup, a team that has beaten them 8 straight times and the most competitive sweep last year. I don't know if you knew that, Nekias. It was the most competitive sweep we've ever seen in NBA history. Nuggets and Lakers, the 2-7 matchup that starts on Saturday night in Denver. Anthony Davis, to me, might be the most comfortable defensive player 30 feet and in. There's never a point where laterally he can't get there, athletically he can't get there, that he's the most adept defensive player in the world, right? He may not win a defensive player of the year, but that's just how I see it.
Okay,
and he was second on my ballot. He was second behind Rudy Gobert.
Okay.
Right? And DeMarcus Cousins clearly does not agree with such things.
I'm not touching that one.
Yeah. Not just, you know, just a quick one. But Nikola Jokic is not bothered by Anthony Davis. Mm-hmm. No matter what Anthony Davis does, he's not bothered by it. And I don't think the Lakers have a chance unless AD makes things just a little more difficult for Nikola Jokic. Because not only is he averaging like 26 and 13 boards, he's having like 11 and a half assists. So he's getting the shot creation and they're, I won't say over helping, but he's creating so many open shots because AD can't handle Jokic.
Yeah, like it's an interesting matchup. Like I'll say off top, I believe the Nuggets win this series barring like some kind of wild injury. So I'll say that up top. There are some pathways for the Lakers to make this tougher. And like something that Steve floated out as we did a watch party last night for the play-in games. How often does LeBron take the Jokic matchup? Because I think the gambit that the Lakers have settled in on with Jokic, let's put a strong forward on Jokic. Let's have Anthony Davis on Aaron Gordon. Let's have you roam around so we can at least limit some of the paint touches. I think in terms of, you know, percentage of shots to come at the rim, it's been pretty much been Denver, Orlando. They've been up there towards the top of the league all year long. And the Nuggets aren't a team that take a lot of threes. So if we can funnel some of these rim shots into paint shots or into mid-range jumpers, into some of the floaters that Jokic admittedly is still insane at. But if we can kind of alter the shot profile a little bit, does that give the Lakers a chance to kind of math it on the other end? Take more threes, make more threes. And then that kind of blends into Denver's defensive scheme. We've seen Jokic more in a drop this year, but as a base, they still have him up at the level. And depending on how the Lakers kind of space around that, can we make Jamal Murray the low man? Can we make KCP the low man? Can we make that low man help small? And so if we are able to float a pass over the top of Jokic, Anthony Davis getting lobs, he's getting to the free throw line now, because they've had Aaron Gordon on LeBron so much. So you have all your size at the top of the floor. You got the smaller dudes behind it now. So like there are ways, if they can figure it out defensively, because it's been a lot of Rui on Jokic during the regular season series. We saw it in the playoffs last year. If Rui turns into LeBron in this case, as he's stronger and just flat out better than Rui is, if LeBron's willing to take on the challenge, what does that do? Does that turn a Jokic floater into an 11-footer instead of a 9-footer? Doesn't seem like much, and ultimately Jokic is good enough to make the shot anyway. But can you win enough of those margins to drop some of the efficiency? Because I pulled up some stuff earlier this morning. On the year, Jokic led the NBA in post-ups. 1.16 points per possession on any trip that featured a Jokic post-up, one of the best marks in the league. Against the Lakers this year, that dropped to 0.97. Smaller sample, that's still a solid number, but that's a sizable jump. And just looking at who defended those post-ups, AD had 11, Rui with 8. LeBron only defended 2 of those post-ups. And I think Jokic only took 1 shot against LeBron in that setup. So as you gear up for a series, even if it isn't just from tip, LeBron has Jokic, do we see that as like a second half adjustment? You take this, Anthony Davis, you continue to be on Aaron Gordon. Rui, we have to trust you against Michael Porter Jr. And so we have some kind of answer here to make things a little bit tougher. Because ultimately, I think Jokic is just going to figure out whatever the Lakers do. He's the best player in the world, in my opinion. But can you win enough of the margins and then make enough three-point shots on the other end to make it closer? I think a pathway is there.
Well, the counter that I would say is, if LeBron is on Jokic for even more than, shall we say, like a handful of possessions, does that take his legs offensively? Mm-hmm. Because Jokic beats on you. And we know that everything is about conserving LeBron's energy base so that he has something in the fourth quarter. And I feel like last year during the conference finals, again, small sample size, Jamal Murray would switch out onto LeBron and LeBron would try to back him down. And it didn't look like LeBron had the energy. Now, granted, Jamal Murray is a bigger, thicker dude. Like he's no like string bean.
Yeah.
And I felt like he held his own defensively in addition to having the best offensive series of his life that we can't necessarily say that's going to guarantee. But I feel like even for LeBron guarding, just to your point, LeBron guarding Jokic, he has so much responsibility offensively to create mismatches, to create, you know, defenses being uncomfortable. I feel like they would shy away from that because they don't know how much energy he has.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's where you zoom out to see D'Angelo Russell, what can you poke at against Jokic and pick and roll? Austin Reeves, what can you poke at? And if you can get enough from those guys offensively, both as pull-up shooters, just general pick and roll threats, can you get enough there? And again, depending on what coverage Jokic is in, depending on how the Lakers space around those pick and rolls, who's going to be the low man because of Denver's aggressive base, can you get Anthony Davis going? Can you get the other ball handlers going so you can have LeBron take on more of those, more of the Jokic matchup for more than a handful? And then you still kind of find the balance of, okay, you have this, but you're able to save energy on the offensive end. And now late in games, we can either just switch that matchup defensively or you keep it, but you have more energy still stored up because of what those other guys were doing offensively. And you can still get the timely drives from LeBron.
Look, what it sounds like you're saying is D'Angelo Russell gets off, Austin Reeves gets off, or at least keeps the game close. Mm-hmm. You can save some for LeBron later.
Yeah.
But if Denver gets out early and LeBron has to go to that, you know, extra nitrogen pack, mm-hmm. just to keep them in it, they are in trouble.
Yeah.
Which, it, you know, look, you're a 7-seed for a reason.
Yeah, and that's why I said at the top, like, I think Denver wins this series. But I guess I don't look at, you know, they've lost the last 8 straight. I don't think that guarantees the Nuggets sweep the Lakers. Like, I do think there is a blueprint, there is a pathway for the Lakers to win games, if not win the series. I wouldn't personally pick it, but it's that is available. It's just a very tight needle to thread there. And so to your point, they have a lot to think about in terms of LeBron energy conservation and just the general productivity. Like AD played last night and played pretty well. Like he was very crucial on the boards, but like got to keep an eye on the fact that he did have the back spasms on Sunday. And just in general, if he does have to take on any of the Jokic matchup, like he's liable to get hurt. Just because he's played, this has been the healthiest season in terms of games played, but he's played a lot of those games banged up. It's a testament to him. But as we get deeper into the season, you do have to keep an eye on, okay, what exactly is the strain on Anthony Davis? Because you don't want anything to happen that turns your, let's say, 8% chance to a 1% chance because he goes down. So it is just a tough matchup for the Lakers.
Yeah, it's the worst possible matchup for them. Like, there's a phrase I used in the last one. They sent the limo. Nikola Jokic sent a limo for Anthony Davis. Make sure he gets here on time tonight because I'm going to wear his ass out. We're at the Lakers. That's what he's like. Just make sure he gets here. Now, I have the pick. The pick I have is that is Nuggets in 5. I think the Lakers get a game. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Lakers got a game, like, in Denver. And then reality sets in after that. Is that how you see it? Because you said there's a path, but I don't think you're necessarily saying. You're not saying. You said, I'm picking the Nuggets to win this series. Do you think the Lakers get 2? Do you think the Lakers get 1? Do you think it goes the distance?
I'd probably say Nuggets in. I probably lean with you like a Nuggets in a top in a tough 5. I could see it stretching to 6, but I'd probably say Nuggets in a top 5 is probably the most likely outcome, barring an injury.
Now, this series is the most, I won't say sneaky fun one for me, because Timberwolves and Suns. The Suns have won all 3 matchups this year. That they won the last 2 in April. But Karl Towns didn't play in the early April matchup. The last one, that was where both teams had something on the line. Minnesota was trying to get down, get the number 1 seed. The Suns were trying to get out of play, and the Suns won that. Minnesota's the best defense in the league. And they got the wings. Anthony Edwards can really strap up. Like, I was really surprised when I was talking to coaches and players, when I was asking them about all defense, and I was saying, who should definitively be there? Mm-hmm. Assistant coaches were telling me, he may not get there this year, but Anthony Edwards really straps it up. He really gets in you. He's like, now, look, you play him off the ball. He may get lost and stuff like that. But in your face, you don't want those problems. Mm-hmm. He's going to be matched up potentially against Devin Booker. How do you see that series just overall playing?
It's a fun one for me just because you talked about Anthony Davis' defense. The defense that the Suns have put on Anthony Edwards during the regular season series has been interesting to me. And I said so on the pod we did the preview. Like, the Suns haven't made up a fancy new defense that teams haven't tried to replicate. The Suns aren't the first team to put 2 on the ball against Anthony Edwards. They're not the first team to put, you know, to turn some of his pick and rolls into late switches and show help behind those switches. But they've just done a really good job of making Anthony Edwards uncomfortable. Like, they've kind of forced him to string out some of these pick and rolls and trust his teammates and make accurate, not just the right pass, but to make the right accurate pass on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they turn some of his pick and rolls into late switches, a lot of help being shown behind that. So he can't just get to the basket, even if he feels like he can win the matchup in front of him. He still has to worry about a layer of help and then a rim protector behind that. And so part of my optimism, oddly enough, is that I don't think Anthony Edwards is going to be as bad against the Suns as he's been during the regular season series. 14.3 points per game in those three games. 0.84 points per possession on any trip that featured an Edwards pick and roll against Phoenix. I simply do not believe he is that. And so that combined with, you mentioned Edwards' defense, Jaden McDaniels, Rudy Gobert, the improvements we've seen from Naz Reid. I think he's going to be very important, both defensively with those second units, but also just his scoring, especially if Phoenix goes to more switching. Like, he's going to have to win those. Karl Anthony Towns, as he continues to work his way back, certainly not an elite defender. He has worked on that end. I do wonder what his matchup is actually going to be. Before even getting into how good he's going to be, I wonder who they put him on. Right. Do they give him the Nurkic matchup and you put Rudy on someone else? I'm really curious to see just how they match up in a literal sense there. But I'm intrigued to see how the Wolves work to kind of loosen things up for Anthony Edwards. Is that just going to be higher ball screens for him to give him space to work with? Is it going to be more Mike Conley just to get Anthony Edwards off ball to flow into some stuff?
Right,
can they
right,
get Nurk
right.
at the level and then flow to the other side and let Anthony Edwards attack that way? So how they open Ant up and just some of the shot making returning, I think it turned the tides there. I do think Minnesota, they have the personnel to defend Phoenix. Phoenix, they can just hit a bunch of tough shots, and they did so during the regular season series. Like, I think I saw a tweet from, I want to say it was Matt Moore, opposed to just how much Phoenix, quote unquote, outperformed their shot quality against Minnesota. And so if you get any dippage there and Anthony Edwards plays closer to his level, like, I do think the Wolves are a better team. I have right. the Wolves. I think I said Wolves in seven on the pod. I think the Wolves can win this series. But it's going to be a fascinating one to watch.
My thing is, when the Suns go small and you put KD at small ball five. Now, granted, I don't want to play KD at small ball five. I think that's too taxing for him. You know, considering now, granted, he's been really, really healthy this year, and he's been really, really good defensively, you know, especially playing all those different points of the floor for Frank Vogel in ways that I didn't think was smart to play him there, considering the injuries and the atrophy that he's had. But he's been really committed on that end. Mm-hmm. Who do they use to defend him if they go small? Because I'm going to assume they're going to try to play Rudy off the floor. Mm-hmm. How do you see them defending KD if they try to go super small? Or I'm gonna say super skinny, because KD is pretty tall.
I got you. I think from there it's just gonna kind of depend on who the fifth is going to be for Phoenix in that case. Cause I imagine big three, you're gonna have Beal on the floor, Book on the floor, KD on the floor. If you go Grayson Allen and Royce O'Neal to close things out there, I'd imagine, like, if they want to keep Rudy on the floor, it's Rudy on Royce.
Right.
And then, like, Cat on Grayson if they just want to continue to have the size on the floor there. And then you just kind of piece it out from there. You still have Jaden McDaniels if you want to give KD that matchup. And you have Ant, you have Mike Conley to close things out. So I think they can do it. It is getting funny because Phoenix can't just use anyone as a screener. So they could put Minnesota in some uncomfortable positions. But I do think they, in a literal sense, they can match up and feel okay. And ultimately, like, if Royce O'Neal hits three threes in clutch time and you lose, like, you just kind of have to tip your cap.
Yeah, you, like, you live with that.
Yeah,
you so, live with that.
But that'd be my best guess.
I tend to go with you that it's one of those weird things where Minnesota's franchise history sort of works against them because we've only seen them get out of the first round once. But that has nothing to do with these players now. We just have a hard time saying the words and fixing our mouths to say Minnesota Timberwolves could be going to the Western Conference Finals. Like, we just don't know how that actually plays out. But when you have the roster, the numbers and everything else, they seem to profile like that. Mm-hmm. I think they win in six. I don't know if Phoenix gets three games.
Okay.
I think it'll be two games of incredible shot making from KD and from Beal, like they did against Denver last year. And then the games where they don't hit incredible shots, the games where you make life just a little bit more difficult for Kevin Durant, where you're forcing him to stand out from 30 feet, take two or three dribbles, and then go into a pull-up shot, giving the defense chance. To me, that's asking him to do too much. I feel like Phoenix hasn't done a great job of making the game easier for him offensively, mm-hmm. but I don't know who on their team would make the game easy for Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm.
And just to quickly circle back to the small ball lineup point, this is also where, like, we've been kind of, in general, just kind of asking, like, hey, what do the Wolves do with all three of these bigs? do we see, like, there's been the narrative about Rudy being played off the floor. We literally do not have time for me to get into that. I just find that very annoying for what we've seen over the past couple of years. We'll leave that alone. But this
it happened one time, and that's become the whole his whole thing, Nikias. You know how that goes. All it takes is one time.
Again, I don't want to hijack your podcast, but I will that's part of the
you are here. Hijack the podcast. Go on the tangent. That's what we're here for.
It's so ridiculous. And like, I understand having the concerns in a vacuum. And with this Phoenix matchup in particular, because of the spacers they could put out and because of the shot makers that they have, I understand the concerns about Rudy being played off. But so much of the Rudy being played off the floor thing is because he has not punished mismatches on offense. It hasn't been because he stinks defensively. And even the series or like the Terrence Mann thing that you highlight on that portion where, admittedly, he did not play the when he was facing the weak side corner, he didn't navigate that well. But part of that is because he is overhelping because the guys up top are getting beat. So, like, not only is the small ball issue more offense than defense, the circumstances around some of the shaky defense was because of perimeter defense, you know, the perimeter guys ahead of him.
Right.
I don't think you have that same dynamic in Minnesota. And bluntly, we just haven't seen that this year in Minnesota. So I don't know why we're still here with that as firm as it is. Keep it in the back of your mind, sure, because even if it happened once 8 years ago, it happened. So it has the ability to happen again. But like, I just don't, it shouldn't be this widespread. Well, don't trust Rudy. That's it. The context is just different. I don't like, but either way, the circle back, like I feel like this is the luxury of having Kat, Rudy and Nas. If you do feel uncomfortable about Rudy, like if you want to do the offense defense thing with Rudy late in games, you can. And just have Nas on the offensive possessions, you bring Rudy back in. Or as Kat is working back, and I teased at the top, like who exactly is he going to be guarding if he's playing 32 minutes a game? If you do feel concerned about the defense, you can just put Nas in there, who isn't an elite defender, but has grown tremendously throughout the year and is a better perimeter defender than Kat is. You trust him more on switches than you do with Kat. The Wolves do have some optionality here. And if all else fails, if you want to go the offense-defense route, you still have Kyle Anderson off the bench. If you want to slide Jaden McDaniels down to the floor, you can bring Nickeil Alexander-Walker in. Like, they have options if you are worried about who's guarding who.
The questions that I've had about the Timberwolves that somebody would ask in the start of a playoff series are questions that you would ask at the start of the season. And I feel like they've answered them. You know what I mean? And they've answered them resoundingly to the point that, look, last game of the regular season, they should have claimed the number one seed. They didn't, but that doesn't erase all the work that they've done, all the numbers that supports. Look, that is a generational defensive player having, once again, a generational defensive year. And I don't think we just automatically erase that because the calendar turns. Now, there are some players who I say when the calendar turns, they either go up or they go down. I don't think I put Rudy in that spot. I just think Rudy is very disrespected because Rudy does dumb shit. You know what I mean? And people, you know, it's just what it is. Rudy sometimes does dumb shit that brings the attention to himself. But I think as a player, especially defensively, like he's a generational defensive player, Hall of Famer. And like, hey, we can just see that. Now, last series before we go, Clippers and Mavs. I feel like this is the third time we've seen this. Producer John, who is a big Mavericks fan, he's probably clapping right now because he can't wait to hear what you have to say about this. Kawhi is dealing with the inflammation in his right knee. They held him out, even though he reached the threshold for the All-NBA, and I did put him on my All-NBA ballot. He was, I don't know if he was second or third team, I can't remember, but he was definitely there. He's on the USA team, so clearly it does not seem like whatever is bothering him now is going to be something that hinders him in the playoffs. Do you see the Clippers having had enough continuity without Kawhi over the past couple of weeks of the season compared to the surge that Dallas has been on post All-Star break?
It gets a little dicey for me with the Clippers. Just because I anticipate Kawhi is going to be back, I don't know which version of Kawhi we get. Just from a health standpoint, we know he's going to be ready for the series. He's going to be amped to go. But I don't know like how healthy he's going to be. I don't know how often they're going to put him on Luka. I would imagine if a game is close, he's just getting that matchup, and Luka's going to try to hunt with switches anyway. But I think we're going to see that late in games. I don't know if they start with Kawhi on Luka, or if they just give that to a Terrence Mann or someone to kind of eat innings in a sense. Because I have the questions about Kawhi, and on top of that, as we saw last year in the postseason, even if he's there and ready to go, is he going to be good for 4, 5, 6, or 7? We don't know. With that uncertainty, like, one, I feel better about the Mavs surge, period. Like, they have better personnel. Luka's been incredible. Kyrie has been incredible post All-Star break. More importantly for me, Luka and Kyrie being used in tandem, that chemistry is continuing to grow. You've seen Luka screen more for Kyrie. You've seen Kyrie screen more for Luka. You've seen more off-ball stuff for Luka. It's hard not to trust the Mavs more than the Clippers right now, before getting into any of the narrative stuff.
Right, yeah.
Because everyone has jokes for Harden and for Paul George, and that's a whole nother tangent. But even before getting into any of that stuff, if you believe in that, I think the Mavericks have just flat out been playing better basketball. And I think for what they want to accomplish defensively, adding that size of PJ Washington, having Derrick Jones Jr. out there, not necessarily the bulkiest dude, but a rangy defender that you trust, being able to flow into different small ball lineups. Maxi Kleber has looked very good defensively in the back half of the year. We will see if he hits the three-pointers that will be afforded to him in the series. That could be a swing factor for you. But defensively, he's been there. So they have the lineup optionality on top of that. It's hard not to pick the Mavs in a series like this, especially with the uncertainty with how healthy Kawhi is going to be. That's kind of where I lean right now. Now, I do have like some specific series questions about how the Clippers are going to match up, what the Mavericks are going to do in certain situations, stuff like that. But, you know, just a quick summary, like I feel better about the Mavs heading into this one.
I feel like I have more answers for Dallas than I do for the Clippers right now. I don't know if, like, not necessarily the James Harden thing, like postseason thing, but the James Harden post All-Star break thing, that he seems to be a little more indecisive. And not like, oh, he's going in tank. He just doesn't, it's in a way doesn't feel like he understands or knows his way. And that's where Russell Westbrook, who is the ultimate feast or famine player, even at this stage of his career, can sort of come in and sort of change the pace and everything. But that's another player that Dallas has to account for defensively. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And Luka, I won't say there won't be a place for him to hide, but this is where I like PJ Washington and Derrick Jones Jr. on this roster. Because you don't have to worry about Luka being drained by all this. Like, when I talked to Jason Kidd, maybe like a month or two ago, they came to Detroit. He was giddy about those dudes because he said, there's just an element of toughness and you're giving me more options defensively to just trot out there and not leave Luka or Kyrie on the island alone.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Luka help point thing is important. Because me and John were talking a little bit before the show about where they could place Luka and where they want to have him. Like, I think the Mavericks just want Luka in the weak side corner anyway, or the strong side corner. They want him in a corner.
Yeah.
So one, to kind of, if he's in the strong side, to kind of eliminate some of the help responsibilities he has. In the weak side corner, he has gotten better at being in early and then closing out in a controlled way. So, like, he's gotten better at that defensively. And then on top of that, you just get Luka crashing in for defensive rebounds and jump starting Dallas's transition attack, which quietly top 10 in pace this year. This is not a team that likes to run or historically hasn't run that often. They've been towards the bottom of the pace rankings pretty much for Luka's entire career. But they're running more. Even if Luka himself isn't running more, like those early hit aheads to Kyrie and letting him jumpstart some things, like that's been important. And the Clippers transition defense has been a problem for the entirety of this season. It was bad before the Harden trade. When Steve and I did our check-in with the Clippers, they started, I think, 0-4 or 0-5 with Harden. And we talked about things. Transition defense was bad. When the Clippers went on that, I think, 26-5 surge, because the offense was great, defense was like hovering around the top 10, the transition defense was still bad in terms of points per possession allowed. And so now you've gotten into some of like the effort stuff with Harden in transition post All-Star break. Once again, it's been bad. And so that right there, more than anything, the Clippers have to be committed to getting back and matching up early. Like, they're not going to be a heavy offensive rebounding team anyway. At least I don't anticipate that in this series. They have to get back and get matched up. And then scram switch or pre-switch if necessary once the possession starts. They got to get back. Because if Dallas is able to get those easy ones, I don't think the Mavericks have elite defensive personnel, but there is a collective size that they have. There is a level of switchability that they have. And if the Clippers are just taking the ball out of the basket every other trip because they're getting blitzed in early offense or in transition, it makes it that much easier for the Mavericks to kind of set up shop and dictate matchups, dictate what the Clippers want to do. That could also flow right into the Clippers tempo question that I've had. Steve has brought up on the pod multiple times. How quickly are the Clippers getting into their actions? What juice are they running their actions with? They can fall into the trap very quickly if they do not clean up the early stuff.
Well, I feel like that's like almost like a Ty Lue staple. And I think Ty Lue is like X's and O's. Like, it's like he and Spo. But one of the things, even when Ty was in Cleveland, they didn't play with a whole lot of pace. Now, granted, that was LeBron, and LeBron's always going to sort of do a lot of controlling under the offense himself, and he's going to be very selective, even when he was younger. Mm-hmm. He's going to be really selective. But that seems to have followed Ty with this group, and maybe it's another function of the personnel where they're not running, they're not getting a lot of early offense, they're not getting a lot of early looks. Paul is a deliberate player. Kawhi is a deliberate player. James Harden is a very deliberate player. So maybe that's just a function of personnel. But you're right about their transition. Like, they don't get back. They're not very big. Like, they're bigger, but they're not like big. They're not tall. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. they're thick. You can play up and play down with them. How do you see this series playing out? Do you see this as a 7-game series because it's the 4-5 and this is the third time and third different iteration this team's match up? Or before I even ask you that, where does Kyrie Irving fit into all this?
Kyrie's an interesting one because, duh, he's really good. He could just be a game breaker in terms of the scoring ability that he has. I really wonder how the Clippers treat him in this series. Because, like, there have been, like, pockets throughout the regular season, zooming out from this particular matchup. But there have been pockets where teams have been like, okay, Luka's just going to get his 32-8-8. Kyrie, you are not about to also have 30. If you come off ball screen, we are sending two to you. And we are funneling these shots to Dante Exum mm-hmm. or Derrick Jones mm-hmm. Jr. or Maxi Kleber or insert role player here. We know Luka's going to do his. The ball from Steve, he is scheme proof. If we trap him, he has an answer. If we go under, he has an answer. If we switch against him, he has an answer. Luka's going to do what he does. We can't have Luka has 32, Kyrie has 30. If Luka's got 32, Kyrie, you are having 18 points if we can help it. So I do wonder if the Clippers at any point in this series kind of tap into, we're going to trap Kyrie, or we're going to aggressively show help behind whoever's defending Kyrie. We're making sure you do not get off, because we know we're not going to be able to just stop Luka. He's going to play with matchups, whatever. Both of y'all can't get off at the same time. We're getting the ball out of your hands because it'll be easier to do so. You're not as good as Luka. You're not as tall as Luka, so you can't see over the traps as well. You're not as good of a passer. Let's see if we can bog down Dallas's offense by trapping you, funnel these shots to these role players. If PJ Washington goes 5 of 8 from three, we tip our cap. If Derrick Jones Jr. goes 3 of 6 from three, we tip our cap. Dante Exum hits three, we tip our cap. I wonder if at all the Clippers tap into that bag.
That's an interesting one, because you're basically saying, Kyrie, go against all of your instincts and make the right basketball decision. Mm-hmm. And by and large, Kyrie has made the right basketball decisions in a ways that we didn't expect him to make with Luka. Like, I don't know how you felt when the trade first happened. I'm like, I don't know how this is going to work. Luka's going to do what he does, and Kyrie's going to want to match Luka doing what he does. Mm-hmm. And it seems like Kyrie sort of settled into the spot of knowing where he belongs, while Luka is also sort of giving him the space and the oxygen to do it too, where Luka doesn't feel like, hey, he's not clapping for the ball. Like, I feel like Luka's still moving without the ball is still like something that, hey, Luka, can you get in some other actions to make a defense account for you when you don't have it? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But I feel like Luka being third on my MVP ballot and was given strong consideration for first, I can't really be asking him to do so much anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm at. But before we go, because this is the last series, where's your pick on this? I feel like you're leaning Dallas, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, I think I have Dallas in 6 or 7. I guess the home game would be in Dallas for game 6. I would say Dallas in 6 in this one. If I knew we were getting, like, Kawhi was just entering the series with no health concerns or relative to, like, the Kawhi experience, if he didn't have the thing where he just missed 3 weeks beforehand, honestly, I still feel better about how the Mavs have played second half of the year. But I'd at least be a lot closer to picking the Clippers, just because they do have a level of depth. They do have lineups they can play with. And Kawhi can just be the best player on the court on both ends of the floor. But with that hesitation in, I lean Mavs in 6 right now.
I lean Mavs in 7 because I feel like Kawhi will have a game where he just gives us like 40. And he will do enough for defending where he just pulls a game out of his ass. And I do give Ty Lue a measure of respect, because I feel like Ty Lue is one of those coaches that he can take his and beat yours and take yours and beat his, one of those types. Mm-hmm. Like, I think from an adjustment standpoint, I do give Ty Lue an edge. But I do think Jason Kidd finds a way to get these dudes playing harder consistently, which I think counts for something in the postseason. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is the great Nekias Duncan. Don't forget to look for Nekias and Steve Jones Jr. on the Dunker Spot. Hopefully I can have both of y'all on together at some point where I can just play referee and just watch y'all go back and forth. some point in the future, man. I really, really appreciate you, man. This was really fun. Thanks again, man.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me, man. Have a blast.
This was fun. John, put him on the list of permanent guests that we don't pay.
Well, on second thought, I had a terrible time.
Thanks to producer John and the entire team who worked so hard behind the scenes on this podcast. No Cap Room. We'll be back tomorrow to preview the Eastern Conference playoffs. I'll be back next Monday for another episode of The Good Word from Denver, Colorado, Lakers, Nuggets. Until then, everybody be safe.